Hi, this is Wade with Let the Bird Fly, a podcast about living freely in a world given back to us. Here for another Winging It session on my book, An Uncompromising Gospel, about which we did an episode, two episodes ago, perhaps by the time you listen to this, perhaps one episode ago. And so far we've talked about the Heidelberg Disputation by Martin Luther, as well as The Bondage of the Will by Martin Luther, which he wrote in response to the writing of the Dutch humanist Desiderius Erasmus. And today we're going to get into what really gives the book its subtitle, the first identity crisis, Lutheranism's first identity crisis that was faced after Luther's death, a very traumatic period for the Lutheran Church. The whole title of my book is An Uncompromising Gospel, Lutheranism's First Identity Crisis and Lessons for Today. And the lessons for today will come in the last of the Winging It sessions. And today I just want to introduce that first identity crisis, which is known as the Adiaphoristic Controversy. And I'm not going to get too heavy on dates in here. I don't want to lose you, but I want to give you the basic date range. Martin Luther dies in 1546. And with Luther's death, there's a bit of a vacuum, a very large vacuum that is left. What is the Lutheran Church without Luther? Now, obviously, Luther would have emphasized that the Lutheran Church has Christ, but Luther's personality was just one that had held the church together and defined it, balanced out, of course, by his colleagues in Wittenberg. 1547 only added insult to injury as the Schmalkaldic League, which I'll explain briefly, was defeated in the Battle of Mühlberg. The Schmalkaldic League was a defensive alliance of Protestant princes and cities, and it was formed, at least for the most part, in the fear that the emperor would eventually invade to try to re-Catholicize, to force the Lutherans to return to the Roman Catholic faith, to submit again to the papacy and to its laws and practices. And so this defensive alliance had been formed and had flourished and had become quite strong, but it was defeated because of the traitorous actions of a fellow Lutheran, John Frederick, who was the leader of Electoral Saxony, which is where Luther had been from, was the cousin of the elector of Ducal, or the prince of Ducal Saxony, Duke Moritz, or Maurice, it's sometimes spelled. And Moritz had agreed to align with the emperor in return for certain rewards, which came to include some of John Frederick the First's land, but also his electoral title, which means he would be able to vote to elect new emperors. That was something that the Elector of Saxony had held before that, and now the Duke of Ducal Saxony would receive that title and be the elector and receive Wittenberg and some other lands or important places as well, it would turn out, once this had happened. And so John Frederick ended up having to kind of split up troops to fight a two-front battle, which is never good, and he was defeated and he was captured. And a man who was always committed to the Lutheran faith, but had his faults, I think, through this captivity, actually grew spiritually and displayed a great amount of commitment to the gospel and to the faith that he had confessed throughout his rule. Eventually, he is set free, but he never regains all that he had lost. And so this defeat in 1547 of the Schmalkaldic League, this league that had been formed in the city of Schmalkald, which is also where we get the Schmalkald Articles named after, where Luther had put together the third Lutheran confession that he had written after the catechisms, the small and large, the Schmalkald Articles. The Schmalkaldic League's defeat meant that now in the span of 2 years, the Lutheran Church or the Evangelical Church had lost its leading reformer, Martin Luther, and now had lost its political leaders, most prominent political leaders, and political protection or safety as well. And now Wittenberg and parts of Electoral Saxony found themselves under Moritz, not knowing what quite to expect. Moritz was a Lutheran, and he had worked out this agreement with the emperor as he understood it, that he would be able to remain a Lutheran. But his cooperation in the defeat of the Schmalkald League defeated or undermined the ability of the Lutheran Church to put political pressure on the emperor to retain some religious rights for doctrine and practice, and really weaken the stance of Lutheranism in Germany and even abroad. And so many of Luther's colleagues who were still surviving were now up in the air about what was the future of the Lutheran Church, what compromises could be made, if any. And so, sorry, I'm losing my voice from a week of allergies and coaching, so I'll be taking some sips of water here now and again to help me keep it. And the emperor, basically, for all that he had reassured Moritz and others that he would allow them to keep their Lutheran faith, presses on fairly quickly with a re-Catholicizing agenda to bring the Lutheran churches back under submission to or under the jurisdiction of the Roman Church and its bishops. And so May 15th of 1548, the Augsburg Interim, named after where political rulers had gathered in Augsburg leading up to this, was published, which mandated a restoration of a whole host of Roman Catholic liturgical practices. It also had some more doctrinal articles or parts that were, I guess, ambiguous somewhat, but clearly were moving towards or opening the door to Roman doctrine. But what Charles V, the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, was hoping to do by this, and we have pretty good indications from his correspondence that this is what he didn't fully intend to do, was to, in bits and bursts, bring the Lutheran Church back first into Roman Catholic practice, and then through that practice, back into Roman Catholic doctrine. And so the question became, could the Lutheran churches in Germany, the territorial churches, individual churches, go along with these practices that were being reintroduced? Some of these practices had remained in some territories, but not in other territories. But for the most part, they were being reintroduced in Lutheran churches in Germany. And so, quite resoundingly, Luther's former colleagues and Lutheran theologians as a whole said, no, we cannot accept the Augsburg Interim. There was a great deal of force being applied, pressure being applied as well, with the presence of Spanish troops, especially in southwest Germany, to force people to go along with the Augsburg Interim. But more in the north and eastern Germany, there was steadfast resistance that this was not acceptable. But Moritz recognized he couldn't simply defy the emperor, especially not as he had just handed the emperor the most political clout, military clout he'd had in Germany since the beginning of the Reformation by siding with him against the Schmalkaldic League. Knowing that, he set his new theologians in Wittenberg to work to come up with some sort of compromise formula which would give up less, would introduce less, but hopefully placate, appease, keep the emperor happy for the time being. For how long? Is a good question. We don't know for sure. If Moritz thought, you know, we can just keep him happy for now, and maybe the political situation will change, and then we can go back to what we were doing. Or maybe this is just as far as we can go for now, or this is the first stuff we can give up, and then maybe there'll be more we have to give up later. But they set to work on this compromise formula. It becomes known as the Leipzig Proposal, and what it tries to do is minimize the amount of practices that are adopted. But it does still adopt a number of practices that had no longer been in use in many Lutheran churches. Moritz's territory had been somewhat more conservative, traditional liturgically, and so some of the things, for instance, the vestment, the surplice, becomes a big point of contention, was still, I believe, in use in Meissen, in Moritz's territory, but not elsewhere, and it became somewhat symbolic for this. And what the authors of the Leipzig Proposal argued was that they were only dealing with adiaphora, that these things, each of them was an adiaphoron. Adiaphora, in Lutheran parlance, the term originates at least with the Stoics, we can take it back, but in Lutheran parlance, it becomes something that's indifferent. It's a middle dinger. It's a middle ding or middle dingen. It's it's something that doesn't make a difference one way or another in and of itself. It can be used perhaps to make a difference, but in and of itself, it's something that can be used without detracting from the message or necessarily even bringing something to it. The formula of Concord, we'll talk about it, and most Lutherans will talk about it as something that's neither commanded nor forbidden. So God's word neither commands it nor forbids it. And so they argued that they were dealing with adiaphora. These were things that could come or could go, could be used or could be set aside, and they were indifferent. They were not going to make a difference. And what this did is set off a rather intense debate about, were these things adiaphora? And secondly, what really is true adiaphora? And I don't want to go too long on this winging it, so I'll just briefly introduce some of the main characters, and we'll elaborate more on this in some later ones too, because everything that all the doctrinal debates that come later flow out of this initial one over adiaphora, which I think is instructive for Lutheranism and for all Christians today, that sometimes the things we think are indifferent can betray a whole lot of differences in theology, or at least theological emphases between us. And so there had been a theologian who originally was from what now we would now is Croatia, had for a long time been under the control of Venice. He's from Illyria, from Labin in Croatia today. And his name was Matthias Flacius. We tend to say in Wisconsin and Missouri Synod circles. I've also heard many say Flacius or Flacius. Matthias Flacius Illyricus. So where he's from, he was called by his enemies the Illyrian Viper. So Illyricus. And he had become interested. He had thought about becoming a monk, and his uncle, who was a monk, and ended up killed by the Venetian Inquisition, which is something we can talk about in another episode, had encouraged him instead to go north and study theology. Baldo Lupentino had been influenced by Luther's theology. He's condemned as a Lutheran by the Inquisition. We never know exactly what that means, because lots of times just any heretic was written down as being a Lutheran. But it seems he had been very influenced by Lutheran evangelical teaching. And so he tells Matthias to go north. And Matthias slowly makes his way there. He studies at a couple other places, but does end up in Wittenberg and becomes a fairly promising student there. He has he gets to know Luther in Luther's later years. He falls into some spiritual depression, something Luther could identify with, melancholy, and Luther gives him pastoral counsel to work his way through it. So Luther becomes very formative for him. But he becomes especially a student of Melanchthon, of Philip Melanchthon, and is very shaped by that. In fact, Flacius learns Melanchthon's method well and applies it well in a number of his works and even in his writings against some of the compromises that were made with what became known as the Leipzig Interim or Leipzig Proposal. And so Flacius actually is studying with Melanchthon. He becomes a Hebrew professor. He works closely with Melanchthon in a number of ways, on a number of projects. And so he's in the loop about all these things, and he's seeing the things, the different articles that are being worked through, the proposals, things of this nature. And he becomes very concerned about what it appears is going to be the compromises that are going to be made. And so he opposes this Leipzig proposal, and he, in a propaganda coup, popularizes it as the Leipzig Interim, this legal formula that was to be followed for a time. And so he identifies it with the Augsburg Interim, which had been attempted, at least, to be forced upon the Germans and the Saxons by the victorious Charles V. And so he ends up leaving Wittenberg. He bounces around in Germany and ends up in the city of Magdeburg, which leads the resistance against the Leipzig proposal and the emperor mandating that people accept the Augsburg Interim or the Leipzig proposal to some extent, depending on the strength of the territories and their ability to negotiate. And Magdeburg publishes like no other city is publishing at this time, and Flacius publishes more than anyone else, even Luther, had in such a short span of time. And he's writing these short pamphlets, Flugschriften, that can be easily disseminated throughout Germany, and he is opposing what is set forth his adiaphora, and he writes one of his important works is on true and false adiaphora, and he argues that in a time of confession, right, when the church must confess because it's being persecuted, when the state is mandating things that the church should be free to determine for itself, then nothing is an adiaphora, he argues, because now the church has lost its freedom, its free consent, and it must then refuse to adopt these things. And the surplus just kind of becomes symbolic of this vestment, and there's a famous woodcut, the devil is behind the surplus, things of this nature. And so this is what becomes known as the adiaphoristic controversy, and I'm not going to give you all the details of the back and forth. I suppose that's something you can get if you get a chance to get the book, if you don't borrow it from someone, I suppose. But there becomes this big battle about, are these things truly adiaphora or are they not? Some, he argues, are not adiaphora under any circumstances. Some, he says, normally would be adiaphora, but are not under these circumstances. And then he gives various other principles in his writings for how church and state should relate to each other in this matter. And this is where I think the Magdeburg Confession that is written and Flacius' writings really are timely for our own day too, and I would love to see some people do some more research on how they view the two kingdoms and how they approach issues of church and state. I've done a little work with that, but it's just something I haven't been able to do as much as I would like. Part of this too, I hope if I'm messing up the narrative at all, you will forgive me. Since An Uncompromising Gospel has come out, I've revised my dissertation, which will be, now it's been sent in and Lord willing will be published in 2018. But then I had also written another book, which hopefully will be coming out in 2017 here yet is my understanding, which is a devotional commentary on Mark's Gospel. The title, is, as far as I know, unless it gets changed last minute, will be A Path Strewn with Sinners. And so I've got two projects I've worked on in between my writing of this, An Uncompromising Gospel, and then what I'm talking about now. Although my dissertation really does focus on this as well, it compares this adiaphoristic controversy in Germany, especially the fight over the surplus, with a vestment controversy in England that happens at the same time, and shows how the Lutherans approach it. While they both come down on the same side of this, the individuals involved shouldn't wear this vestment under the current circumstances, they approach it theologically in very different ways, and I think it shows an important lens for understanding how Lutherans approach the gospel and Christian freedom. But what basically will happen in this fight over adiaphora is the city of Magdeburg will be placed under siege, both by the emperor and Moritz, who really doesn't want to have to do so because it's terrible publicity for him. But they will rather courageously hold out for quite some time. And finally, when Moritz and the city come to peace, not a surrender, but they come to peace, Moritz realizes, A, the importance of supporting the Lutheran faith if he's going to keep his constituents, if we can use that term for this time period, happy, but also the emperor's position has since weakened, and Moritz actually now turns on the emperor and is able to essentially drive him in any meaningful way out of Germany for the time being. And Lutheranism thus survives, or at least survives in a confessional manner in Germany. And then also this helps with its standing abroad. And the Formula of Concord will adopt Flacius' position that in a time of controversy, especially when the state is trying to mandate doctrine and practice for the church, then nothing is an adiaphora. And then the formula will also adopt many of the same principles for how to deal with determining what is adiaphora in the church and what the proper use of adiaphora is and isn't. Article 10 of the Formula of Concord is an episode in and of itself. I think perhaps one of the most useful articles in the formula for everyday church life, but also maybe one of the most abused articles in that it's oftentimes selectively quoted to be presented as saying something it's not necessarily saying. So this gets a little bit into, I think, one of the major players in the second half of my book then, Matthias Flacius Illyricus. and his opposition to the Augsburg interim and the Leipzig proposal or Leipzig interim, and then also to the issue of what are adiaphora. And all the controversies that follow are going to, in essence, flow out of this controversy. It's going to be people who had taken a side in this controversy now, sometimes through attempts to defend the side they had taken, addressing other doctrines. And we see that during Luther's lifetime already then, there had been theological fault lines within Lutheranism. And what happens is this pressure of this controversy and then adiaphora themselves allow those fault lines to become evident, and in some ways then they break. And we can see in which ways Luther's uncompromising gospel had either been received and adopted by those who had studied with him or taught with him, and in what ways some of his longtime colleagues had perhaps always been ill at ease with some of the harder edges of his teaching, especially as expressed in On the Bondage of the Will. So this is a longer winging it session, and I apologize for that. But this is, to be honest, the core of the research that I do as a historian, and my PhD is in history and intellectual history. And so especially the historical side is fascinating to me, along with the theology. And I think there's a lot that can be learned, historical lessons as well as theological then, too, as we look at this period. But it gets into what I've spent hours and days and weeks and months and years doing research on, writing on, thinking about, both in my time at study in Europe and then in the States, and even in the time leading up to my grad study. This was something that I had been very interested in. Before that, most of my presenting in some way comes back to this as well. So if I got a little wordy, I apologize. But I do think it's something that's important for the church today to consider, especially as even if most Lutherans don't know what it means, we still love to throw out that word adiaphora oftentimes as a get-out-of-jail-free card. And I think so this can be a timely reminder of how it's important that we think through all that we do and how well it serves our confession of Christ and the gospel and then the proclamation of law and gospel. So with that, if you ever have any questions on these Winging It sessions, feel free to email us. That information is available, how you can contact us, and I'm happy to answer those as best I can. Comment on the Facebook page. That might even be the best way. Let us know if you have questions. I'm happy to try to address them, and we will then continue with some of the other controversies that flowed out of this in the Winging It sessions to come. Thanks for your time, and I hope you spend the rest of your day letting the bird fly.
Every evening when the sun goes down, get my party and I begin to clown. I don't care what the people are thinking, I'm not drunk, I'm just a drinker. I set them up, another round, I set them up, another round. Another round, one more round won't get me down. Came home last night, all full of lush. My babe began to fuss, and I said, honey, I don't care what.